You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, it's a welcome back to Carl Marshall from the UK's Centre of Fortean Zoology to take a dive into the world of cryptozoology and the methods utilised in the field. From sea serpents to the kraken, giant hogs to pizzlies, Bigfoot to black cats, we dive into a range of mystery creatures on land and in the sea to look into the possibilities of cryptids from around the world. Carl is great company, and it was fantastic to have him back on the show again. I'm sure you'll discover something in our conversation to intrigue and enlighten you. The show has now officially moved to Audio Boom, which I was humbled to be invited to and bring Mysteries and Monsters to their platform. As always, you can support the show and get ad-free episodes by signing up to our Patreon. Please click on the link for show notes and you'll get early access, ad-free episodes, and a new bonus series focusing on poltergeist and ghost cases from the UK's past. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the channel on YouTube too. The website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. Artwork, as always, by the wonderfully talented Dean Bestall. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Carl Marshall to dip our toes into the world of cryptozoology from around the world. Today, it's a warm welcome back to Carl Marshall, one of the assistant directors of the Centre of Fortean Zoology and one of my favourite big cat specialists. Carl, welcome back to the show. How are we?
I'm very well, thank you, Paul. You?
Yes, I'm very good. As we were joking before, I know we planned this for a little while, and we're going to cover a range of cryptozoological subject matter in today's chat. But I think we best start with this sort of accidental discovery that you have been given your own categorization of sea serpents, Carl.
I was quite surprised by that as well.
So, how's this happened, and where has this come from? Because I know we're going to dive into some sea serpent stories later, but fill us in regards to how this accidental discovery came from and what it all means.
Okay. I developed a system for categorizing sea serpent sightings back in 2018 for a paper I wrote for Animals and Men magazine. And I was influenced mainly by the Hoiselman system, the Lauren Coleman Hume system, and the Woodley system. I initially created 12 types, which are the great seahorse, which is probably some sort of long-necked pinniped, which is likely cosmopolitan in range. This is the equivalent of Hoiselman's long-necked sea serpent and the merhorse categories. So I developed a system for categorising sea serpents. That was back in 2018. That was for Animals and Men magazine, and I thought nothing more of it, really. And then I went online the other day, and I noticed there was something called the Marshall system, and I thought, what's this? So I clicked on it, and I realised it was me and my own category, my own classification system, which I could actually go into detail a bit if you'd like me to.
Yeah, absolutely, because I know it's one of those things, because I think when you talk about sea serpents, people just think you mean long-necked serpent or snake-like creatures, but as we both know, as lovers of cryptozoology, it is far from that simple, is it?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Initially I developed 12 types, the great seahorse, which is probably some sort of long-necked pinniped, which is a seal. This is very likely cosmopolitan, and it's the equivalent of Hoiselman's long-necked sea serpent and his merhorse categories combined. He had them as two separate species, but I think it's probably a matter of sexual dimorphism, and it's maybe males and females. Yeah, then there's the giant sea centipede, which I think is probably an Arthropleurid, which is a gigantic prehistoric centipede. This would be equivalent to Hoiselman's many-finned sea serpent.
Yes.
Coleman's great sea serpent, and the segmented sea serpent of the Champagne system.
And something that, when I've seen fossils and the throwbacks to some of these creatures in the past, Carl, they were terrifyingly frightening.
Well, enormous, yeah.
And obviously very voracious predators as well, I believe.
Mm, very much so, yeah. I mean, the eels especially so. I mean, I've actually got a category called the mega eel, which is basically a category I created for new species of eels, serpentine sharks and swamp eels and oarfish. So it's sort of a catch-all category, really, which is equivalent to Heuvelmann's super eel and his yellow belly category, which I think he made defunct later.
Yeah, I mean, they're another one as well. I mean, I've often been very frustrated, and I'm sure you've come across this as well, that whenever someone talks about sea serpents, there are certain people out there that simply say, oh, well, they've seen an oarfish.
Yeah.
Now, I know enough about oarfish to know that they don't behave anything like the vast majority of sea serpent sightings.
Absolutely. It's a pretty poor identity, really, when you think about it, when you take everything into consideration.
Yeah, because they're a very sort of, wouldn't not necessarily say a lazy creature, but they're one of those creatures that tends to let the ocean do the work for them, aren't they? They just drift around.
Pretty much, yeah. They're very, very lazy creatures, really. They behave very oddly, but say we don't really see that behaviour because it's such deep waters.
Absolutely, and I think, I remember a few years ago I heard a call on another show called Monsters Among Us, where someone had rung in with a sea serpent, and then the week after somebody rang up to completely dismiss it and say, oh yeah, it's an oarfish, doodle, and just basically made up loads of stuff about oarfish that none of it was true, because...
Yeah.
My experience is they're very rarely filmed at all in the sea.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking maybe a dozen occasions that people have actually captured them on film. I know Jeremy Wade famously found some when he was doing one of his river monster shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Out in the sea. And they're just stunningly beautiful. But once again, we only seem to see them when they're dying normally, I believe. And that's why they sort of come to the surface or get sort of swept inland.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm not even suggesting that there couldn't be a category for giant oarfish. You know, that's quite possible. But that certainly doesn't... the average oarfish certainly doesn't explain the phenomena of the sea serpent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there's a couple of terrifyingly large creatures on your list, which is obviously the giant crocodilian creatures that could possibly exist somewhere, and also the giant shark, which is one of the most notable modern sort of interpretations that everybody... There is a certain... set of people out there who constantly keep pushing this megalodon being still out there.
Yeah, well, that's very unlikely, but, you know, there could be large, you know, giant unknown sharks, though. It wouldn't have to be megalodon.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, was the megamouth the last one we sort of stumbled across?
Yeah, and that was discovered in the 76, I think.
That was caught by accident, wasn't it? Because I think, was it a Japanese scientific team that were doing something completely different, and then this shark just turned up and ate whatever they put on the seabed?
Absolutely, and we had no information about that. We weren't expecting it at all. It was, you know, it was not a cryptid, really, because there was no real previous information about it. That's not debatable anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, and I mean, that, sometimes that's one of the wonders of nature, Carl, is that when people aren't actually looking for things, something just turns up.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I made my great shark category broad. So it's just for any unknown shark, really. That's, yeah, that's equivalent to Lauren Coleman's system of the giant shark. You know, so it's just a catch-all category for any large unknown sharks.
Yeah, absolutely. And then obviously you've got things like giant octopi. And...
Yeah, I've removed the giant octopus from my system recently, actually. Because I developed it with Octopus giganteus in mind, which was the specimen that was found on a Florida beach. And that's been pretty thoroughly debunked recently. You know, the specimens that they've got in the museums or in the, you know, what they've got on record, they don't imply it's a cephalopod at all. So I've removed that category, and I've also removed the category which I call BB's Mystery Manta, because that has basically been proven recently to be a physiological anomaly. They change the pigment patterns on their bodies to communicate with each other, so it's not a new species, but nonetheless, William Beebe did see something, you know, he really did, he didn't make it up, so it's still pretty impressive.
Yeah, so do they change their coloration in similar to how octopi and others do it in that kind of way, Carl, that they're trying to sort of communicate emotions and things like that, then, mantas?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's what BB saw. It was real, it just was something we didn't know about the actual species that we are aware of.
That's incredible. And how long is it since we've realised that they've had that ability then?
Well, I read it a couple of years, well, maybe about a year ago now, maybe a year and a half, in one of Carl Shuker's articles.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, if Carl Shuker says it's nothing, it's nothing.
Yeah, well, Carl usually does all the legwork and we all sort of just say, oh, yeah, we've read this and let Carl... Carl does all the work for us and then we just talk about them.
Yeah. So, you know, I had 12 categories originally and now I've got 10 now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's nothing wrong. I mean, that's the thing about what we're talking about here, because we're generally just talking about cryptozoology and the cryptozoological methods and things that people use. And I think often it's this ability not to adapt and change based on new information, Carl, that can sometimes cause problems when we're talking about things like this.
Absolutely, yeah. It's got a bit vague recently, cryptozoology has.
Mm. I think it's one of those things where certain... I mean, there are always big arguments I often see when people are talking about things like Mothman and other such creatures, and they're saying, is it a cryptid? Is it a monster? Is it something else? And it's very difficult when, essentially, cryptozoology is supposed to be the study of unknown animals.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's the
zoology,
definition.
It's a bit of a giveaway, yeah.
Yeah, well...
Yeah,
exactly.
Poison
was new. Yeah, precisely. And I think often these days, because of the internet, and there's so many sites and so many YouTube channels and so many web pages out there, a lot of things tend to get mixed up, where if you really want to sort of say, right, this is the framework I'm going to use in regards to what defines a creature.
Mm.
I think when we start talking about magic and mystery,
yeah,
it's outside that framework for me. Is that how you
Absolutely.
Would view it, Carl, going forwards?
It is. That's exactly how I view it. To me, cryptozoology is the methodological study of animal forms that are known only from testimonial evidence, circumstantial evidence, or from dodgy material evidence, basically, which is considered to be insufficient in some way. You know, that's about as basically as it can be put.
Mm.
The word comes from Greek roots, kryptos, with a K, meaning hidden, zoo, meaning animal, and ology, which is the study of, so that makes cryptozoology the study or science, if you like, of hidden or unknown animals.
Yeah. I mean, often I think as well, people tend to shoehorn all kinds of things. I mean, I think if you asked most people if they could name a creature that they would associate with cryptozoology, other than, you know, Nessie or Bigfoot, a lot of people would sort of say, well, Tasmanian tigers. But then again, that's the different aspect of cryptozoology for me, Carl, when we're talking about animals that are allegedly extinct as well.
Yeah.
How do you sit with that? Because obviously, I mean, the Centre for Fortean Zoology's emblem is a Tassie, isn't it? So...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got my own sort of categories of cryptids. I mean, lots of cryptozoologists have. Mine's pretty simple. It's got five main types. Type one would be animal forms that are similar to known living species but showing obvious phenotypic variation. So the Morosi reported from the montane forest of East Africa is a good example of that, of a type 1 cryptid. It's supposed to be an adult lion displaying the spots typically associated with cubs.
Mm.
So that is my type 1. That's a good example of my type 1. My type 2 would be animal forms that are similar to known living species but out of place. So you can put the alien big cats into that category.
Yes.
Which I like to do because I have a lot of, you know, a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
My type 3 is animal forms that are similar to known living species that are reported to be unusually large or perhaps diminutive varieties of known living species. So that would be like giant boar, 30-foot anacondas. The pygmy rhinoceros from Liberia would be an example of a diminutive rhino.
Mm.
And before that sounds ridiculous, you know, you've got to remember the pygmy hippopotamus was discovered from Liberia, the same country, so it's not out of the question.
And obviously, my experience of the pygmy hippo is Madagascar as well had a population, I believe, did they not, Carl?
It did, absolutely. I mean, if Madagascar hadn't been so badly deforested in recent years, we might have found some real mysteries there.
I know Forrest Gallant, who is, to all intents and purposes, a cryptozoologist.
Yes, he is.
I know when he was doing one of his, because he's been to Madagascar a few times looking for some, because it's a wonderful ecosystem there of wonderful creatures that you can't find anywhere else on the African mainland mostly.
Yeah.
He obviously went there looking for the pygmy hippo and actually stumbled across a skeleton in a swamp, which seemed fairly recent. So that is an enticing one. And like you say, if we've got pygmy hippos, why wouldn't we have a pygmy rhino?
Exactly. I mean, Forrest Galante basically is practicing what I call practical cryptozoology. He's using many of the methods that we all use, but he's using it to try and find species which have got higher probabilities of success.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's your type 4 then?
Type 4s would be animals that are similar to known extinct species. Hmm. So this would be your Sasquatch, you know, surviving dinosaurs that are said to inhabit remote areas of, say, sub-Saharan Africa and Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
And my type 5, which is my last category, which is animal forms that appear to be unrelated to any known living species or extinct species. So that would be like Stella sea ape.
Yes. Yeah.
And that basically sums it up.
So, ideally then, is it difficult sometimes, especially in this modern age where, as you refer to, and we both are friends and have got to know Dr. Carl Schuker, who's probably our most eminent cryptozoologist, primarily because the amount of investigation that Carl tends to dive into is frightening sometimes.
Mm.
And he often talks about creatures and cases I've never even stumbled across until Carl sort of brings them to his attention with his fabulous blog that he writes.
Yeah.
In regards to you, Carl, when you've got this five types, these days, I think it's very difficult because it seems that we're only sort of concentrating on maybe one or two, because Bigfoot and Sasquatch and the Yeti and whatever tend to be classed as the sexy ones because they're the ones everybody's out there looking for, it would seem, on face value. But I think we both know enough people who are out there across the world under normal circumstances looking for some of these weirder ones. So out of the five, which is the one that excites you the most?
Well, I think the type three is the most viable category of them all. Just the example I gave earlier of the pygmy hippo being discovered. You know, that was a pretty incredible discovery, and it was completely cryptozoologically tracked down. You know, that's exactly how it was found. It was using cryptozoological methods. So I think the type three is probably my type three is probably the most likely category.
In regards for yourself, Carl, who are the people that we look back on and the titans of cryptozoology that are really the people we need to sort of use as great examples of people going out there and travelling the world looking for a wonderful variety of wonderful and weird creatures?
Hmm. Yeah, well, obviously you have to start with Hoivermans, really.
Yeah.
Dr. Bernard Hoivermans. He's the zoologist who actually codified cryptozoology, so really it's his baby, I would say.
Hmm.
But it goes way back, you know. You've got Charles Gould, who wrote Mythical Monsters in the 19th century. That was essentially cryptozoology.
Yes.
Willy Lee, who's a German naturalist, who's actually associated more with rocketry, I think.
Mm.
And, he wrote quite a bit. I've got a couple of his books here, actually. He wrote Exotic Zoology, Dragons in Amber. Dragons in Amber is excellent, actually. It really is a must-read for anybody who's interested in the history of cryptozoology.
Mm. Do you think it's difficult? And I've spoken to a few people recently. Ken Gerhardt and Lyle Blackburn, especially, are two modern cryptozoologists who, for me, are always paying back in regards to the people that have come before them, Carl.
Mm, yeah.
Ken especially, because his latest book is covering Nessie. And he's very, very kind and obviously gives credit where it's due in regards to Roy McCall.
Yeah.
Who's one of those people that, when I was a young man and I was getting excited by monsters, Roy was one of those people I first came across because he appeared on Arthur C. Clarke, obviously, off looking for Mekele Mbembe, which is obviously one of probably the most famous lost dinosaur that we've got out there.
Mm, he wrote some great work, yeah.
Once again, though, he's one of these people that, despite the fact that he did have a biological background, a lot of naysayers were very sceptical and dismissive of his work, which, for somebody that, you know, was an employee of a university in the biology department, and I think he became the head of zoology.
Mm-hmm.
Columbia, I think it was. I find it frustrating that these people sometimes get poo-pooed as if they've got no idea what they're talking about, and yet McCall is a prime example of somebody that actually had the knowledge and the wherewithal to back up what he wanted to try and discover.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should always be sceptical, and he knew that as he was doing what he was doing. That's the meaning, you know, that's the objective of science. It's like Bernard Hoivermans, the father of cryptozoology, he had his critics as well. really, essentially, he just presented a methodology that we can use to target and potentially identify new species of animal. But it's completely up to us as cryptozoologists how we interpret and utilise the data.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's difficult because there are certain projects that are going on right now around the world. I mean, I'm a massive fan of the work that the Olympic Project are doing in Washington State.
Hmm.
Primarily because they seem to be coming at it like Hulverman's did, that they're using a very analytical, scientific exploration in regards to trying to prove what they hope is out there, rather than
Absolutely.
A lot of other people in the Bigfoot field tend to just be going out and trying to capture it, and then there's all the different camps, you know, is it magic, is it an alien, is it a relic hominid, whereas the Olympic Project, they are just going, well, this is the science, these are the people we're using, and we are just trying to find evidence.
Yeah, I mean, cryptozoology is basically just the method. You know, the outcome is either the discovery of a new species or it's actually, you know, a reanalysis of the evidence. It should go around as sort of simple as that.
Mm.
You know, if the investigation is properly executed, then this is when cryptozoology will actually bridge into zoology.
Yeah. Do you think Hulverman's gets overlooked these days in modern cryptozoology, or is it one of those people, Carl, for you, that for people like ourselves, as you've referred to him, he is the father of cryptozoology? Without him, we probably wouldn't be...
Well, his work on the track of unknown animals is kind of like the Bible for cryptozoology, really.
Mm. Yes, it is. And
a lot of his ideas are now out of date.
Yeah.
The basics of, you know, how he did his work, you know, the academic level he was at, being an actual doctor of zoology, obviously gave him a certain amount of standing.
Yeah, and I think that's often a difficulty that people who work in the zoological field sometimes find, Carl, when they're dealing with situations like this, because for a lot of people, once you dip your toe in the world of unknown animals, a lot of people in the professional capacities simply look down on these people as though they've lost their minds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. By definition, you've heard people say, you know, once they're discovered, cryptids become zoology. You've heard that, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, you know, by definition, I would say there's more to it than that. You know, I would say following formal discoveries, it's actually really perspective zoology. Once, you know, just as soon as you get out there in the field, a cryptozoologist is a perspective zoologist, whether or not they're misguided or not when they're actually searching for unknown animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen numerous occasions where people have been doing cryptozoological expeditions and they've discovered lost animals that we thought were either extinct or weren't even aware where they were. So it's very interesting that for some people it seems to go beyond the pale, and it's something I've mentioned before. I find it very frustrating as someone that has a foot in both the cryptozoological camp and the zoological camp, that for me, I don't understand where this cutoff point is for searching for things. Just because they're not supposed to exist doesn't mean they don't exist, regardless of what part of cryptid and cryptozoological searches we're talking about. I think there have been enough weird discoveries around the world, even in the last 50 years, that I think to completely dismiss everything that doesn't exist because we simply don't have certain evidence is a little bit frustrating. But even though I know, you know, we both know that this field is full of hoaxes and charlatans and all kinds of people taking advantage, and has been since time immemorial, sadly.
That's right. I mean, the point is, if a cryptozoologist isn't at least a good naturalist, they'll be very, very unlikely to ever discover anything new to science.
And I think that's the other key aspect here, because often, you know, I'm a big believer in citizen science across a numerous fields, Carl, because I think astronomy is a prime example of the average people making incredible discoveries around the world and has done for decades. And I think this can also sometimes happen in the worlds of zoology, where people spot things or notice things that perhaps have gone under the radar, or certain organisations simply don't have the manpower to actually investigate fully.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's not a science technically, you know, because there's no funding.
Mm.
I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know if we can honestly call cryptozoology a science.
Mm.
You know, not in the same way like entomology is a branch of zoology that's concerned with insects, or paleontology is the study of ancient life through fossils. I tend to think of cryptozoology more as a targeting methodology than a true science.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good thing to do, because it obviously keeps you grounded and based in reality.
Yeah. I mean, one aspect that's extremely important is that a cryptozoological animal form or a cryptid is ambiguous. It's got to be ambiguous in some way, either in its morphology, its physiology, its behavioural traits, or, you know, just maybe its appearance in modern times. And it's often said that a cryptid must be ethno-known. You know, that means known to the people that inhabit the area that share its environment. But I honestly think that this kind of limits cryptozoology's potential. While it's not inaccurate, and it certainly is, I think a more suitable statement would be that there must be some previous knowledge, no matter how circumstantial or maybe even trivial.
And I think often there is an issue when it comes to situations like that, because too often in the past we've seen science dismiss the information given to us by locals and people of original cultures around the world as if it's just folklore and myth and magic, Carl.
Yeah.
And yet, time and again, things happen where it's proved that they're actually telling us the truth. These creatures, whatever they are, across the world, are existing in certain areas. And time and again, animals are rediscovered or found in areas that simply we had no concept of. Like we've touched on about mantas there.
Mm-hmm.
What we think we know is constantly developing. And I think when you get in a situation where you think, well, we've discovered everything, we know everything, there's nothing to learn, I think you're in real trouble, regardless of the fact.
The term monster is the problem.
Yes.
I mean, like I already said, an unknown animal has to be unusual. That's either in its appearance or its behaviour, you know, just to be noteworthy and suitable for the folkloric process. There must be something out of the ordinary about it. You know, a new species of shrew, the same as any other species of shrew, isn't going to inspire the same kind of awe to make it noteworthy.
Mm.
But, you know, if some strange same shrew that was thought to be invincible was reported, you know, that would make it much more interesting. You know, and that actually has happened. It's now called the hero shrew.
Yes.
Scutosaurus sumereni.
Yeah, and what? Tell me about that.
It's basically got a... it's not invincible.
Yes.
It's got a... it's evolved a corrugated interlocking vertebrae, which is basically unique in the species. So the local people knew that you couldn't tread on it, basically. They thought it was indestructible. So that's a cryptid, or what I would call a micro-cryptid.
Right, so if you tread on it, it simply repels it.
According to the stories, they are so strong, they are indestructible. And when this was discovered, Scutosaurus sumereni, it was proven to have a corrugated interlocking vertebrae.
Fabulous. And where are they found?
Africa.
Goodness, that's amazing. I mean, but once again, that shows us, I think you just sometimes take things for granted. Well, not you personally, Cal. People take things for granted, and I think, once again, nature will always throw up weird things that just change our concepts and understanding. I know recently, and this is one of those weird things that happens occasionally, I've noticed a lot of articles over the last few weeks that are talking about pizzlies, which are...
Oh, yeah.
The polar bear grizzly hybrid. Now,
yeah.
As a lover of monsters and documentaries, I've been aware of this phenomenon for probably the best part of 15 years.
Yeah.
And once again, this is one of those where people reported that they were seeing bears that either looked like an amalgamation of a polar bear or a grizzly, or it was a grizzly that looked like a polar bear with the colour and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at the time, it was dismissed out of hand, or it was like, oh, it's just a one-off.
Yeah.
Now, we see that there's a real trend going on here, and once again, that's changing our understanding of how bears interact, because obviously, the thing about North America is you've got the three key bear species there. You've got the grizzlies, the blacks, black bears, and you've got polar bears. So, for me, it was interesting to see that due to environmental situations, that seems to have just developed over the last 20 years. So when we have a situation like that, Carl, do you think that's something that's probably always gone on and we've just never really picked up on it? Or do you think that is something that's actually happening right now, that it's something that's developed over the last 20, 30, 40 years because of what's going on in North America in that area?
I think it's just a byproduct, really, of climate change. I think that what's going to happen is we're going to lose them. They're not going to go extinct. They're just going to speciate back into the brown bear. You know, so we'll lose the grizzly, the polar bear will be gone. It will be no bear that looks like the polar bear anymore. It will just become a new kind of bear that's adapted to a different environment.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it is remarkable as well that, and it's often a cliche when people say, but nature will find a way. And obviously, for the polar bear's continued existence, it's coming back into the bear family tree, really. Because I think, didn't they all split off about 5 million years ago or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where they all sort of diverted. But once again...
I mean, that was unusual at one point. The idea of a grizzly bear was really unusual at one point. Now we know it's nothing, you know. But at one point, that was considered, you know, almost a cryptid.
Yeah.
And like I said, the real progenitor of the cryptozoological process is ambiguity. It's got nothing to do with monsters.
Mm.
It's the ambiguous nature of cryptids that makes them notable. But we should also bear in mind, of course, that the ambiguity of a character, you know, is a character that can't be precisely measured.
Yeah.
You know, one aspect that's thought to be out of the unusual to one observer might be quite typical to another.
Yeah, and I think the other aspect of that was, once again, as you refer to the term monster there, I think at the beginning people were trying to sort of say, oh, well, we think it might, people are seeing a remnant of the short-faced bear, which is obviously a terrifyingly ferocious creature in our past. I think we'd know if they were wondering about. But even so, I think when you have two species such as the grizzlies and the polar bears coming back together and merging, you've got to kind of consider what aspects of it genetically are going to go forwards, because they're both, you know, ferocious creatures in their own right, Carl. Kind of generational hop are we going to see here? Are we going to get a grizzly with a polar bear's ferocious strength?
That's a really good point. I mean, who knows? We'll see, won't we?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, that's not the kind of experiment I would like to be involved in, to be fair, because, you know, I think it's a fascinating topic, because it's something that's happening right now, and we just do not understand what the ramifications for the bear's genetic code's going to be down the line. Is it, are we going to see grizzlies that develop into more polar bear type behaviour, or are we going to see polar bears that develop into more grizzlies, or is it going to be some kind of amalgamation where you get the very best, and some perhaps would say the very worst of both species, going forwards into the next generation? And if so, how is that going to water them down? And do we get situations where grizzlies mate with black bears, Carl? Is that something that's occurred in the past, or is that something that's simply not been noted so far?
I would say that they probably speciated apart too long ago. I wouldn't think that they would be viable anyway.
I mean, once again, I'm thinking off the top of my head, you're looking at coyotes and wolves, which is another one that didn't seem to be well known, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah, but they, you know, they're not as old. They speciated much more recently, so they are capable of still crossing over. Cats especially, cats are very new, really. And most of those, especially the smaller varieties of cats, they can all interbreed.
And obviously, you're very aware that we do get the big cats that will cross-pollinate as well, if they have to, depending on situations in captivity, don't they?
And we should always remember as well that the puma isn't a big cat.
Mm.
The puma is actually a little cat, it's just a big little cat.
Yes.
Its basic anatomy is exactly the same as, well, not exactly the same, but it's very similar to the small cat. Yeah, pumas can't growl, they can purr.
Yeah, which is, as far as I was once told, that's what makes a big cat, is its ability to roar.
Whether or not the hyoid bone is ligamented.
Ah, and that's the difference, is it?
Yeah.
Interesting. But then again, that's another species where, you know, and we've talked about this before, the amount of people that see big cats in places that they're not supposed to be around the world, Carl, continues. I mean, often we laugh as we see a picture of an out-of-focus domestic cat running across a field somewhere down south, especially in your neck of the woods. I think there was a couple of cases the other week, and then obviously we've had the flap that was going on in Italy, which seemed to have been somebody had just released a pet into the countryside.
Well, that's right, and I think that's where a lot of them come from. They're illegal pets. There's still a trade in big cats, and certain unscrupulous owners, maybe say drug dealers or something like that, they like to have them as status symbols.
Yeah.
And when they can't keep them anymore, they just get out of hand. They either release them or they escape from poor enclosures. It happened in France back in 2019, if you remember. There was a black leopard wandering around in Nice.
Yes.
On the rooftops.
Yeah, it was a stunning creature. And I remember that because people were going, it's a cat. And I'm like, have you watched this video? It's clearly not a cat. And that, I think, is one of those things where, once again, Carl, you've got an aspect of this problem, especially when it comes to the cat story, that we have a hidden population of animals that, until something gets free or escapes or is sadly released with no concern for its welfare going forward, we've no idea where these creatures are most of the time.
That's right. And once they rewild themselves, they're gone. you know, you would never see them again, and that's exactly what happened.
And we've seen over the years as well, there's so many situations where weird things will happen. I know you touched on earlier on giant boars.
Hmm.
America is going through something of an infestation in regards to their boar population, which has just exploded. But once again, there was the very famous story in the mid-noughties of Hogzilla, as it was called, Carl.
Yeah, I remember.
And now, yes, there was a little bit of exaggeration in regards to that. But when they found the corpse, it was still enormous.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things, because once again, you have a creature that is extremely stealthy, has a large appetite, can cross-breed with normal pigs as well, and has a tendency to... Basically, you could walk past a boar in the woods and you wouldn't know it was there unless it wanted you to know.
Yeah. Usually when people find boar in the woods, it's because they've stumbled across the hoglets.
Yes.
And then the mother will then go mad, and they're very dangerous, actually, at that time.
Absolutely. I remember watching a documentary about this, and all the dogs, because they have to use dogs in America, because they're that fast. I think they can run up to 30, 40 miles an hour a boar in full flight, Carl. Mm-hmm. So they are extremely quick. And obviously you're dealing with creatures that are living in dense undergrowth.
Yeah. And they rip up truffles like nothing with just their nose. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All the dogs that they sent after them, they'd got all these hounds, all had to wear Kevlar bodysuits.
Yeah.
Primarily just to protect them from the tusks. And it makes you wonder just how many of these large hogs, for example, are out there. Once again, another creature. I mean, you see it all the time. It's like moose. People go, oh, well, you'd expect to see moose. The amount of times I've heard people talk about moose just appearing in front of them, and you think, well, it's an enormous creature. Surely you would be able to hear it. But we forget that a lot of these animals are used to making as little noise as possible.
Yeah. I mean, the giant boar would be, again, that would be one of my type 3 cryptids, type 3 categories. And funny enough, there's been stories from the Forest of Dean in Gloucestershire for over 100 years of something called the moose pig, which is supposed to also be a gigantic pig. And that sort of lives on today whenever, you know, oversized wild boar get caught. It's the moose pig come back.
So that's a long-held tradition of a mysterious creature in that area then?
Yeah, it goes back hundreds of years. It goes back to when the wild boar were gone.
Yeah, well, yeah, because once again, that's something that seems to have taken hold over the last, 30, 40 years? Because I think weren't a lot of them just released?
Yeah, happened by the early 1990s, people started to see them again. And since then, they've just basically took over in places like Cinderford in the Forest of Dean. The areas where the kids play and stuff, there's often activity of wild boar where they're just ripping up the ground and generally making a nuisance of themselves.
Yeah, I know. I've got a friend who lives in that area, and he woke up one morning to discover that his back garden had been redeveloped by something.
Yeah, the moose pig.
I shall tell him, and that'll make him sleep well at night on his own. In regards to the other aspect of this, obviously, is, as we touched on at the beginning, in your Marshall system then.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about the world of cryptids and cryptozoology and unknown animals, I know we've both sort of agreed on this. For me, if we're going to find anything unknown to science as we know it, or something that turns up that we're not expecting or is allegedly extinct, for me, the sea is the key area where it's going to be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt.
So, for you, what are the most enticing aspects of that then, Carl? What do you think we need to keep an eye on? What are the ones that perhaps have a better possibility of being out there, or fact, what kind of species would we discover?
Well, anything that's a fish really has got a really good chance of discovery. So the giant shark category, that's a really viable category. Giant whales, there's plenty of whales being discovered all the time, both toothed whales and even a baleen whale, I believe, was discovered in the last 5 years. So, yeah, the sea is without doubt the most viable place for new discoveries. But, you know, they've got to be known. They've got to be previous knowledge for them to be a cryptid. An unknown animal on its own, just that hasn't been discovered, is not a cryptid. You know, there are certain categories which are certain criteria, shall I say, that are really, really important.
Yeah, exactly. So in regards to that, what do you think are probably, like you say there, whales are another creature where we believe we've discovered them all, and yet...
They keep turning up, don't they?
They keep turning up where they're not supposed to be. We discover that some of them are more intelligent than we could even possibly contemplate. And
Well, there are literally millions of species. You know, they're mainly invertebrates that we haven't discovered, and they haven't been scientifically described and validated. And most will be discovered without any prior knowledge of their existence. And so, by definition, those are not cryptids.
When you look at places like the Atlantic, or the Pacific especially, these are such vast expanses of water.
Mm.
And I know it's one of those things that is often repeated, Carl, that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do what on Earth is under the sea. And you look at the pressures and the terrain that's under the sea. I'm not surprised when anything turns up from under the sea that people go, what on Earth is this? Where has this come from?
People think it's unusual and a monster until it actually turns up, and then suddenly it's just an animal.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, the cryptozoologist is basically trying to find the animal behind the monster. You know, we don't look for monsters. Monsters don't exist. You know, we're looking for the animal which has been mistaken for a monster. Yeah. I mean, the gorilla. The gorilla is a fantastic example. The gorilla really should be looked at as the prototype for all problematic cryptozoological ape men.
Mm.
You know, like the gorilla, the Yeti, if it does exist as a flesh and blood species, it's not a monster. It never was. It was, you know, it's just a new species of animal, possibly even three.
Well, yeah, and I think you're quite right in this. I think the problem we've got with this is that people say they're looking for monsters. And when it comes to things like the Yeti or Bigfoot, it depends. I mean, obviously, it depends which camp you come from. But if you need to push me into a corner, I'm going to say it's some kind of hominid, and it's some kind of primate of some description. So for me, that's not a monster.
Yeah, it's just primate, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. That's an animal that we've either lost sight of, or it's kind of drops off the radar.
Yeah.
I think the term monster gets overused when we're talking about creatures of all kinds, be they mammals or lizards or reptiles or fish. It's a term that gets dropped out. The giant squid is another prime example, where 150 years ago, the Kraken was this legendary massive monster that would take ships down.
Yeah.
Once again, that's probably another great example of a creature that was dismissed, poo-pooed, nonsensical, and yet we are still learning so much about giant squids and where they live and how big
well,
they
I've
can
got
even
a question
get.
For you.
Mm.
What you know, we think that the Kraken has been discovered and it's Arcturus. That's the main theory, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, what if Arcturus just hints that the trophic levels in the sea are adequate for larger species, and the Arcturus is just an example of something that can be eaten by another squid?
Mm.
The Kraken could still exist, not necessarily the giant squid.
Yeah.
You know, it could still be a whole new different type of cephalopod, which is even larger, and one that's perhaps more capable of some of the traits that are attributed to the Kraken.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, Carl, if I'm honest, because when it comes to things like that, it's one of those things, especially when you're talking about some of the reports that we've had over the years, and even into the modern era, because squid themselves, giant squid especially, are not known for coming to the surface once again, similarly to oarfish, unless they're ill, or they're dying, or they've been injured.
That's the idea, yeah.
So, and yet, there are numerous reports of people having encounters with tentacles coming out from the sea. I'm trying to think of that. There was a very famous incident, I think, with a round the world yachtsman who claimed to have been attacked by a giant squid.
The problem was he was on his own though, wasn't he? And he couldn't back it up.
Precisely. I mean, to be fair, I mean, why would you come out with that? Because at the end of the day, that's the kind of situation where.
Well, I think the race he was on was called the Jules Verne race or something like that.
Yes.
So it could well have been a publicity stunt.
It could be. But then again, you've got to wonder about these certain situations, because he got nothing to gain from that story other than probably professional ridicule. But
that's true.
You then look at what a lot of whalers and people used to say in the 19th century about these, Carl, that there are certain creatures that would simply just appear from nowhere, especially when they were in the throes of a whale hunt, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And people would often mention that tentacles would come and take people off the deck, which is not something we've ever recorded or seen in a giant squid.
No.
At all.
It's an exaggeration.
And it's one of those things that I think, did none of it happen? Is it one of those stories that's just got passed on without wishing to cast aspersions on sailors? Often they are dismissed as the teller of tall tales. But freak waves are a prime example of perhaps you ought to listen to people, because they had gone on for years by saying that occasionally you would be in a dead calm sea and then a giant wave would just come and smash you. And science completely refuted that until we had one recorded in the North Sea in the 90s. And then all of a sudden after that, we've suddenly realised that there are these waves that can reach what I think the largest one recorded so far is 120 feet. And God forbid anybody's out in the ocean when one of those hits, Carl.
Yeah, you'd never survive that, would you?
No. And you see some of the damage that's done to these ships, and you think, well, how on earth did these people explain what had happened to them if it wasn't a freak wave? You're thinking, what's got the power to punch through an oil tanker in the middle of the sea? Because you're not going to have hit a rock, are you?
No.
When it comes to things like stories of the Kraken, I would not be surprised to discover that there's another species of squid out there that's even larger than what we know so far.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, also as well, a giant squid at the surface, just starker-toothed ducks, if it's dying at the surface, what's to say that it won't grab onto a ship if it gets too close? You know, in its death throes, it'll grab on maybe, and that story could then be exaggerated into, like you say, of tentacles coming onto the deck and snatching sailors off and whatnot.
Absolutely. And who knows, it might have actually caught somebody by accident. And, you know, with the greatest respect, if a squid's tentacle grabs hold of you, there's not much you can do to get out of it, whether it's dying or not, Carl. And it's one of those things that there's often a famous meme that goes round, or articles occasionally go round, that completely dismiss all sea serpent sightings as people seeing whale penises, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, it's one of those arguments that gets put forward by certain scientific outlets.
Well, if a whale penis can be higher than the top sail of a sail ship, then yeah, okay. But as far as I know, there is no whale that big. I mean, that whale would be able to eat the blue whale.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's not just an exaggeration. You know, I think that theory maybe is a bit of a cop out.
Yeah, I'm not saying that some of them probably were that, but I know enough sea serpent reports and encounters from sailors and ships that hardly any match that. Most of them are usually about serpents swimming alongside, so I don't know what's going on there
at all. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or they're usually seen swimming past, and occasionally they'll rise up, but a lot of them are just seeing things swimming past or going under a boat or something like that, whereas I think it's very easy to look at a sceptical explanation or a scientific explanation, and it once again it becomes one of those things, Carl, where it's a one size fits all. This explains everything, even though it doesn't. And for a lot of people, they go, oh yeah, it's just that. But then you think, well, what about the reports where people see creatures' heads and the mouths opening, and they tell us about the teeth and the eyes? And you're like, well,
yeah, multiple witnesses, you know, a ship full of people, a ship crew, an entire crew seeing the same thing can't just be dismissed so easily.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, touching on what we were saying about the Kraken, I think, is it the USS Stein is a very famous incident where they were attacked. I think they had a sonar beacon on the bottom of the boat.
Okay.
And they were attacked by something. They've no idea what it was, but it left teeth in the or claws in the actual casing of this sonar.
Mm-hmm.
Largest ever recorded. No idea where it was.
Yeah, maybe it's the bloop.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. There's another thing. I mean, these are the strange things that we come across where certain sounds are heard around the world and things, and people don't know what they are.
Yeah, the point is, the sea is an exciting place with a lot of discoveries to be made.
Well, it's a matter of opinion, the word exciting. Dangerous might be a better word, Ken. Terrifying for some. I mean, it is one of those things, because there are so many stories about creatures, like, you know, as we've touched on earlier on, you were talking about the Stella Sea Cow, which is another famous cryptid that basically seemed to have hit prominence sort of the 18th century and has completely drifted away from us these days.
Yeah, and it doesn't really correspond with anything.
Yeah, because it's very unusual. It's quite similar, but it's very different as well, if that makes sense. So what do you think in regards to creatures like that? Is it once again, I mean, this is the other thing. We just presume that people are out. I don't know how many ships are out in these areas at any one time, Carl, but often you will see people at sea and they can't see anything. There's no ships anywhere near them. And you just think, well, what on earth is going on around you? You know, 20 feet under the surface, you've no idea what's there.
It could be anything, couldn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know if that's a reassuring thought or a terrifying one.
I think it's fantastic. I think that's what life is all about.
It is. And it's, you know, we see it so many times. Even in animals that we've understood and we've catalogued and we've watched, Bull sharks are a prime example. I mean, how has that member of the shark family developed the ability to be comfortable in fresh and salt water?
That's incredible, isn't it? The tiger shark as well is also one that tends to wander into river systems, I believe.
Yeah, because there was some marvellous footage the other year when there was some real bad flooding in Australia, and two bull sharks turned up on a golf course in a lake.
Really?
Because they've got washed in.
Yeah.
When you see things like that, and yet there will still be famous cryptid stories. There's a famous one about people claiming that there was a great white shark in a lake somewhere in North America. That can't happen. And even pointing out to people that it's physically and scientifically impossible for it to be a great white, a bull shark, yeah, couldn't.
Exactly. It might just be an exaggerated account again.
Exactly. And even though you pointed out that it can't possibly be a great white because it would die, however, it can be a bull shark, they'd rather go with, no, it's a great white, rather than the actual possible explanation
of it. Then debunk it as a great white and completely ignore that there may be a bull shark in there.
And we've seen that it happens in Australia, you know, God forbid. And once again, there are notable instances of bull sharks swimming up rivers and streams and tributaries in the States and attacking people. The famous, obviously, Jaws was famously based on a series of attacks during the First World War, which were all blamed originally on a great white. And it's only in recent years that people have realised, well, it was clearly a bull shark that killed these kids.
Yeah, that's right.
So, in regards to that, what else is it that excites you about the possibilities of the ocean other than the vast expanses and depths?
Well, there's just the potential for giant animals. You know, there aren't many places left in the world which are capable of concealing giant animals. I mean, there are a few places on land, not many really. You know, going over to the Sasquatch for a minute, I mean, I'm prepared to say that there are, without any doubt, a few places on Earth which are capable of concealing unknown primates, even a few hominids maybe, but and the Pacific Northwest is certainly one of those places, so you never really know. But when it comes to the sea, the entire area pretty much is cosmopolitan. You know, there's a good chance that something new could turn up anywhere, and it really could be a giant.
I mean, it's one of those things as well. I would imagine that there are certain species, Carl, especially when it comes to the sea, that have no capacity to stop growing.
Mm.
When we look at some of the creatures that we already know that live in the sea, I mean, Jeremy Wade's work has been outstanding, primarily for introducing me to species of fish that I never knew I should be afraid of.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a grouper? Is one? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, don't mess with a group.
Oh, I've seen stories. I mean, there was a very famous incident on one of his episodes where he was interviewing somebody who had basically been trying to do something off the side of the boat, and a grouper just came up and grabbed his hand and nearly killed him, pulled him under.
Yeah.
In regards to things like that, how many species have that capacity to just keep growing, Carl, do you think?
Well, lots of species. I mean, a lot of species of fish. Species of fish are quite capable of continuing growing throughout their entire lives, and a lot of species don't even really seem to show any potential of aging as such. They don't seem to deteriorate in any way. You see this with sharks. You know, they'll be fine, and then just suddenly they'll die without showing any sort of sign of deteriorating or aging. You know, they just suddenly die one day. So yeah, it can go both ways, really.
I mean, whales are obviously a prime example of a creature that seems to live for centuries.
Most species, in fact, we really don't know how long they live.
Was it the Greenland shark that they've recently mentioned that's over 500 years old?
I did hear that estimate, but I'm not doing any details really about that. But yeah, I mean, it's possible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it makes you wonder, with the technology that we have these days, if they do tag things, what the possibility is for some of these creatures, such as whales and fish out there, eels and sturgeons and catfish as well, that can grow to enormous sizes, even in very limited situations, Carl. What the potential is out there for them.
Yeah, it could be anything, really it could.
So, it's one of those conversations where I'm frightening myself thinking about things. where do you think, do you think there are specific hotspots around the world in regards to the areas of the sea, or do you think it's all fair game, Carl, that the ocean just has so many secrets we have yet to uncover that anything could be basically hiding in plain sight?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, it's true when they say we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the oceans, and that is completely true. The tropical zones are probably going to be the most viable, but there's no reason why brand new species can't be discovered in the Channel, in the English Channel, you know.
Yeah, well, the British media are obsessed with trying to get great white sharks around the British coast every summer, aren't they? So,
Well, maybe, you know, maybe in the next 25 years or so we might have better evidence for that.
Yeah, it's one of those things, I think, because things are changing around us and the environment is moving and nature is taking great steps. I'm never surprised when something weird... I mean, obviously, we've recently had two walruses turn up. What I found was interesting, that some people were saying it was the same one, and when you saw pictures of them side by side, they didn't look, you know, not that I'm saying I'm an expert in walrus identification, they didn't look the same animal to me. One looked considerably different to the other. And yet, people seem very surprised, but that's another situation where animals we don't expect do turn up more often than not.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times does a whale swim up the Thames, poor things?
Yeah. About 10 years ago, there were some reports from the River Arrow, which is in Ulchester in Warwickshire, of a seal. And I spoke to my colleagues at the Butterfly Farm, where I was working at the Butterfly Farm at the time, and I spoke to them about it, and they said, you know, Carl, just ignore it, it's going to be an otter. And I thought, well, the reports that people are making don't sound quite like an otter, especially the feeding behaviour. So I went and had a look, and it was a seal. It really was a seal. So that, as far as I know, is the most recorded inland encounter with a seal. And it was basically me checking it out through using cryptozoological methods.
How far inland was that?
Ulchester. So it's all, you know, it's West Midlands.
Blimey.
Yeah. And that's online. You can find photographs of that guy.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, I've seen stories of seals being found sort of 7-8 miles inland from a beach. And basically, somebody's walking home one night and they find a seal in the middle of the road. But that's amazing. So it had swum all, it swum up from the channel then?
Up the channel, yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a seal in Worcestershire, in Worcester City, which I forget its name now. But a lot of people thought that maybe if it was a seal in Ulster, which it was, they thought it would be the same seal. And like you say, with the walrus, you know, I checked it out, I looked at the markings, and it was a completely different seal. So seals do come further inland than we think.
Fantastic. I mean, that's another thing as well, because obviously seal populations have exploded in North America, especially in California, since they've become protected. Would you say that that's something that, once again, you're talking about a creature that's more often than not very comfortable in water? Do you think that happens more than we realise?
Quite possibly, yeah. I think that the long-necked sea serpent type sea serpent, which is reported cosmopolitanly all over the world, I think that's very, very likely a pinniped, some sort of long-necked, fully pelagic pinniped, a species that gives birth at sea, you know, something in between, if you like, in between the whales and the seals, that never comes to land, and it gives birth at sea, and that's why we don't know about it.
And I suppose it depends on the areas it lives in, because certain creatures, you would imagine, if they reside in the Arctic or the Antarctic, there's going to be a real lack of opportunity to even study anything like that.
That's right, there's nobody there, is there? So the data is limited. It doesn't mean that the animals aren't there.
Well, that's the other aspect as well, of course. You have to base it on the potential of an encounter. And I think Antarctica, you've got something like a 3-month window where you can even attempt to try and get on it if you're not flying in.
That's right.
You know, because the sea ice just blocks the whole continent off from anybody getting close to it. So once again, you're based on a very narrow set of data where we simply don't have the boots on the ground to even see what's going on there.
That's right. I mean, and testimonial data is one of the key points of cryptozoology. You know, it's a good chance that the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, if it exists, is much further north up into Alaska. But there's nobody there, so there's very little data.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's another key aspect of a place that Alaska, yes, it's part of the American continent, but you look at Alaska and northern Canada as well.
It's far more likely to conceal something.
Absolutely. These are vast expanses of land, and I know, as you touched on earlier about the Pacific Northwest, I often see people who are in the deep forests of Canada, and it's like they're on an alien planet, and I think it's one of those things that people presume that we've explored everywhere, Carl. We know everything, we know where everything is, and yet there are numerous parts, especially in that area of North America, where you are probably 200 miles from the next town, or even the next house.
Absolutely.
Anything could be out there.
There is absolutely something going on in North America, which is more than enough reason for a dedicated study.
Well, I think that's the thing as well, because once again, as you refer to that, you've got that situation where in certain situations, people think that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever, is simply a modern phenomenon. But that only occurs if you ignore everything that was reported the previous 200 years.
Yeah, there are a lot of historical reports.
Absolutely, and I think they come from all over that area, and they're all across the United States. I mean, there are newspaper reports going back to the 1850s of... I mean, that's the other interesting aspect. As our knowledge of creatures increased throughout the latter part of the 19th century, it's very interesting when you look at these historical reports in North America, how they gravitate from wild men to gorillas.
That's right.
And I think once people began to understand more about the world, then they were able to say, it looks more like that than that. And that's very interesting because, yes, gorillas are human-looking, but they don't look like a wild man. I'm often amused by these stories, Carl, where there seems to have been this presumption that if somebody decided to go live in the woods, they'd just become really hairy. And I don't know what the train of thought was in the 1850s and 60s that they seemed to believe that that's what happened to people when they went, because whether that was based on the fact that, you know, certain animals, when you release them back into the wild, they will go feral very quickly. Pigs are a prime example of, I think, within 4 weeks they will start to grow hair again and their tusks will start to form.
Okay.
Maybe wrong, but people say they, out of all of the domestic animals, pigs are the ones that go feral quickest because they just revert back to what they know, which makes you wonder, well, why are they quite happy just wandering around a sty, you know?
Well, they are true survivors and they can eat almost anything.
Well, yes, absolutely. Pigs are known for their appetites, pigs and goats especially.
There's probably a very interesting, well, like I said about the pygmy rhinoceros from Liberia, there's a possibility that it's not a rhinoceros at all, but some sort of giant pig. And that wouldn't make it any less of a discovery.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, these are very resilient and hardy animals that seem to exist in numerous areas. I know often people will dismiss certain animals appearing. Big cats in the UK, people go, oh, well, they'll not survive the winters here. And you're like, do you know anything about cats?
Well, they do okay in the zoos, don't they?
Yeah, well, exactly. And obviously you've got a lot of them living in the wild. You know, we've got snow leopards and Siberian tigers. I mean, where do they think these... How do they think a snow leopard got its name?
They need to look at the range of the puma and see how broad that is.
Absolutely. And you only have to look at what goes on in the States with cats, you know, with cougars and jaguars. Once again, I think it's that misunderstanding that certain areas, when you think about creatures crossing over from Mexico to America, everybody thinks that Mexico and the southern US is red hot all the time. It's really warm. But the winters can be extremely harsh there. So these creatures are clearly surviving somehow.
And they have a slightly denser coat in the colder areas. You know, they adapt to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that kind of variation in different species across the world. Obviously there are certain foxes that have a different type of coat. Are they known as the naked fox or the bastard fox? I think it is.
Okay, I'm not sure. Yep.
And it's one that doesn't have the outer layer, so it rather than its normal fox relative,
it's just got the guard hairs.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very rarely spotted, but it only comes out in the day because it can't retain the heat, whereas a normal fox it tends to be more nocturnal. Though these days, depending where you live in the UK, that some of them don't seem to be nocturnal at all anymore.
I've got a hair sample right now, looking at it right now, of a black fox from Basingbourne. Completely melanistic. I got a sample from it, which was analysed. It proved to be a hybrid between a raccoon dog and a red fox.
Is that from the UK?
It's been bred somewhere for the skin trade or the pet trade. And got released at some point and quite possibly reproduced with red foxes in the area.
Well, the raccoon dogs are one of those things that these creatures, Carl, that nobody ever hears about. And then all of a sudden there seems to be a big flap, because I think there was a story a couple of years ago that people had seen them or they'd been released into the wild, as you refer to there, that, you know, illegal pet trade. And people were being warned not to approach them because they can be quite grumpy, from what I gather.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I remember once going on a golf holiday with some friends, and we went out for a drink at night. And we went to a pub by the coast. And I was extremely surprised to bump into a couple with their pet raccoon on a lead.
Right.
So, you know, feeding it peanuts, which is probably not the best diet for a raccoon, Carl.
No. But the interesting about the raccoon dog, though, is it's a different genera.
Yes.
It's a completely different genera to the red fox. So they shouldn't hybridise, but they obviously do.
Isn't that interesting? How recent is that?
This would have been about 2014. I spoke to the biologist, Helen McCroby, who was analysing the samples, and she sent me some samples for us to analyse as well. Yeah, they are. They're black fox and they're hybrids. Because the raccoon dog has got a thick fur, so they introduced that into the red fox stock to give them a thicker coat for the fur trade, unfortunately.
Oh, dear. The interesting aspect of that is often people will say, well, if you crossbreed species or different genus, usually the offspring will end up being infertile. And yet, more often than not, we see examples, as we've touched on in regards to grizzly bears and polar bears, and as you're touching on there, Carl, clearly sometimes that train of thought is very wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, we know now that the mule is quite often viable, which is supposed to be infertile.
Yeah, because I think, don't they say that about in regards to ligers and tailands? Are they infertile?
I think so.
And yet,
yeah, I think so. Like but we don't know it, do we? We've obviously got something wrong.
Yeah, I mean, because that might simply be the examples or the creatures that we have to hand. It may just be them that are infertile, rather than it being an issue that affects a species if it's allowed to populate.
Further studies definitely needed.
Absolutely. Once again, it just shows you how often nature will just surprise you. When you think you know everything, often things will just occur. I mean, it often makes me chuckle. A few years ago, I wasn't aware of this at all until somebody mentioned it. But I didn't know we'd got a capybara population in the Norfolk Broads that...
Oh, yeah, quite a large one. And maras. Maras are about to. Maras are slightly smaller.
Yeah, and once again, here you have a set of creatures, a continent away, Carl, quite happily living it up.
Yeah. They just adapt.
One of the best examples, I mean, very interesting. I was reading the article about the hippo population in the Amazon that's exploded because of them escaping from Pablo Escobar's private zoos.
Yeah.
And obviously they have nothing to fear where they are. And I think there was only a handful that were released nearly 30 years ago now. And the population swelled, obviously, because they've got no predators or anything to worry about. Mm. And it seems that the locals have fallen in love with them.
Yeah, the folkloric element's taken hold. They're becoming monsters. People are coming up with stories about them.
Yeah, but the people, it seems, don't want the authorities to get them. They're trying to obviously deal with the situation and basically stop the population continuing to grow at the rate it is.
Mm. They inspire the sufficient awe to be worthy of the folkloric embellishments that are often applied to these animals.
Yeah, and I suppose it is remarkable when you think that you've got, once again, a creature completely out of its comfort zone on a different continent that has just flourished.
No predators at all.
Yeah, nothing to concern it, because obviously, I suppose the largest thing it might bump into there is either a very big anaconda or a caiman. Other than that, there's not much that could even... I mean, that you'd probably say that would probably go after a hippo calf, but full-grown adult wouldn't have a chance.
The mapinguari is real.
Yeah, well... Very true. Very true. You never know. Chupacabra might turn up as well and have a taste for hippos. But once again, that's, you know, it's an alien population. And I'm sure if we didn't know what had happened there, those stories would be completely dismissed until something happened. Because unfortunately, the thing with hippos is they are extremely territorial and extremely ferocious. And sadly, I would suspect it might take a fatality for people to begin to take them a bit more seriously.
I think that's why Pablo Escobar had them anyway. Mm. I think he was probably using them as, like I said earlier, like a status symbol.
Yeah, very true. And I'm going to say, if you have a disagreement with someone, you just lock them in the hippo pen for a night.
Yeah. Well, how sorry they are.
Yes, or what's left of them anyway. Well, Carl, what's next for you then? What are you working on? I know you touched on you're still trying to get your excitingly intriguing book in regards to micro cryptozoology completed. So what else have you been up to and yourself professionally?
Well, I've made a shorter version of that, which I was going to publish in the Journal of Cryptozoology.
Mm.
But that's taking quite a while at the moment, so I think I'm going to actually go with animals and men, publish animals and men, so the idea, my methodology is out there then get back to the book at some other point, because like I say, I lost a lot of my material for a while online, and I had to get it back, so it put me back quite a bit. But it's slowly but surely, it is happening, and see, I've got a fully working methodology anyway, which can be applied to small, unknown animals, which is quite viable, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you still sort of looking forward to getting back out into the real world when we can travel?
Richard Freeman recently mentioned that we might be going to Papua New Guinea when we can, which would be really interesting. Now, just for me personally, for the Dobsenga, which is supposed to be a thylacine-type animal, some sort of pouched wolf.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, Richard's mentioned a couple of foreign trips, so I don't know whether he's trying to encourage me to want to come along or just scare me. Cool. I'm not sure, Carl. not sure how much use in the field.
Well, I know
that
he thinks a lot of you anyway.
No, that's very kind of him, and it's a mutual. He's a very very kind gentleman with his time and his support. He's been very good. So, how's the biology degree going, by the way?
Fine. Yeah, slowly ticking along.
Yeah, nearly there.
Yeah, taking up a lot of my time, unfortunately.
Well,
you know, trying to find time to do everything's not easy.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what, in regards to, what's your next adventure for yourself? Because I know, obviously, when we've spoken before, you've been around the world on the hunt for wonderful creatures. Carl, is there anything you want to do next, personally?
Well, at the moment, we're in the process of investigating a lynx-type cat in the Forest of Dean. Which I actually did get some pretty interesting data from in the form of a spore, which I decided, before I did anything with it, I sent it to several specialists, Carl Schuker being one, Darren Nash another, and they basically verified that it is, in fact, a lynx. So that's really, really good data. So we're basically going back there over the weeks, putting camera trails out, putting camera traps out, and trying to see if we can catch something.
Fantastic. I mean, it was very... I was talking with someone a few weeks ago, Carl, who was absolutely adamant that they'd already released lynxes into the wild in the UK. And I was...
Yeah, I think that's the case.
Do you think that that's happened?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. That's where they come from. The chances of them being a surviving population of the British lynx is almost not worth considering. But there's a really good chance that we've been introducing them for a long time. And not all one species as well. I mean, there are four different species which could have been introduced, and they could all hybridise. So maybe at some point when we reintroduce the lynx officially and they start reproducing, we might look into their DNA and start noticing markers that might imply that other species might have been present in Britain beforehand. That might be a good way of proving their existence.
Yeah. So when did that spore turn up? How recent is that?
That was back in 2019, just before COVID outbreak. COVID really got in the way of that one.
Well, that is intriguing, because like I say, it's very interesting that some people are of the opinion they're out there anyway. And when, I know it's in regards to some aspects of this, Carl, people will say, well, that's not very exciting. Whereas I think, oh, well, lynx is out there, back in the wild where they belong. It's fantastic news.
It gets away from the monster hunting aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing, and the lynx is a very maligned cat as well, because I know some people, oh, they'll be attacking kids and all this. If you know anything about lynxes, you know that's just not what they do at all. They're very solitary animals who like to keep themselves to themselves, aren't they? They don't sort of hang about in generally noisy areas.
And they can require very small ranges.
Yeah.
You know, the Forest of Dean would be large enough to actually house a small population of Forest of Dean in the Forest of Dean indefinitely.
And just not bother anybody at all, wouldn't they? They just happily do their own thing.
Oh. I mean, we've collected hair samples now, which we're getting analysed by Lars as soon as we can. We're just trying to get some real data that we can use.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I look forward to that. Keep me informed.
Okay.
So, where can everybody find you and keep up to date with any of your forthcoming work then, Carl, please?
Okay, well, you can reach us at www.cfz.org.uk, or you can get me personally at carl@cfz.org.uk. We have a variety of Facebook groups as well.
Brilliant. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure speaking to you again. It's been a long time. I know it doesn't seem that long, because we do talk a lot anyway. But thank you, as always, for your time and a thoroughly engaging and interesting conversation tonight. So thank you, Carl.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Paul.